it impacts poor people. It impacts communities of color. The whole criminal justice system is racist to its core. It's built on a history of slavery, and that shows up in how things are enforced, what the consequences are like, and all of that, right? Even within this already racist system, private prisons disproportionately affect people of color, even on top of that.
Welcome to the Problematic Podcast, a show that gives you the chance to be the hero in helping solve some of the world's largest problems. Find out which teams need your skills today at problematic.app. And now, here's your host, Sean Tierney.
All right. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Problematic Podcast. I'm your host, Sean Tierney, and I am here today with Robert Craig. Robert is Associate Director at Abolish Private Prisons and co-host of the Prison Cells podcast. He holds a JD from the University of Pennsylvania Carey Law School and clerked for the Ninth Circuit and the District Court in Arizona. Welcome, Robbie.
Thanks so much for having me, Sean. How are you doing?
Good, man. Good. Good to have you. So I think today what we're going to be talking about is mass incarceration and the prison industrial complex and private prisons and some pretty gnarly topics. Can we start just with a little background on you? Like, how did you get here? What did you do? What's your background?
So I graduated law school and then started clerking, and I had known John through some personal connections in Phoenix when I was teaching before I went to law school. And then I was in Arizona and he needed some help with another project that he was working on with the Department of Housing and Urban Development with some research for one of the tribes in Arizona. So I had been volunteering with him for a couple months on and off, just with research questions when they popped up for him. Finished clerking and he reached out because he had started this new project called Abolish Private Prisons and wondered if I could help him out with that. So the few months in the fall, I was, you know, volunteering when I had time. And then we got the opportunity to sort of bring me on as a full-time position through some very generous donations, sort of a seed project to see if we could really get the Abolish Private Prisons Corporation, the 501c3, going. And I've been working with John ever since then. It's been about a little more than five years now.
Okay. And so the function of this podcast is really to inspire and educate our listeners and our volunteers on issues that they can work on. This is a particularly gnarly one. I started getting into it about a month ago and started reading about it. I read the Shane Bauer American Prison book and a bunch of stuff. I listened to all the podcast episodes that you guys have released, which are very good, by the way. If you're listening to this and you want to go deeper on this, they have something called the Prison Cells podcast, and it does a really good job of just drilling into all these issues that we're going to talk about. But can we just start with some definitions? Like, mass incarceration, what is it? Is it, it's just a lot of people behind bars, but can you just explain, like, what is mass incarceration?
Yeah, I think, you know, a lot of people behind bars is sort of the best definition you can get. And I think in the United States especially, we talk about it as what's happened since the 1980s. You had this war on drugs, which criminalized with harsh penalties the possession of a lot of substances. And then between, you know, the mid-1980s through the 2000s, there was a drastic increase in the amount of people that were behind bars in the United States. And I think we call the mass incarceration, you know, effect or movement or something like that, that the shift in the way that we treated people and criminalized a lot of things to the point where we are today, where there's so many, you know, 1.5 million people or so behind bars at any given point, and orders of magnitude more than that who are involved in the criminal justice system in other ways, you know, probation and post-release supervision and diversion programs. And so a lot of people are entangled in the criminal justice system. And specifically when we're talking about mass incarceration, it's the amount, just the shocking amount of people really that are behind bars in the United States.
And that, so that 1.5 million is constrained to the United States. Can you speak to the number globally, or what percentage does the US represent to the rest of the world in terms of prisons?
Yeah, I the numbers tend to vary, but I think we have about 25% of the world's people, like of all the people that are in prison worldwide, the United States has about 25% of them, which is like a shockingly high number. when you can compare like how big our population is compared to the rest of the world.
Right. We've got like 4% of the people, but
yeah,
a quarter of all the prisoners.
Exactly. So it's, you know, it's like 8 times or so, you know, 7 or 8 times as much as you would think just based, you know, if everybody was equal across the board based on population. So we really do lock people up like basically nobody else in the world.
Yeah. Okay. More definitions. Prison industrial complex. How do you define that?
Yeah. Prison industrial complex is one of the things that it sort of, I think, goes along with how we try to systematize things in the United States. But generally, when we're talking about something as a complex, we think about the inputs and the outputs that make up a giant system. And so you have a lot of complicated relationships that are going on inside the prison system and a lot of people who are making money off of it. So you have not just private prisons that we're going to focus on today, but even in public facilities, a lot of private vendors are reaching into those facilities and making profits off the labor of people in there. You have vendors who are making money by serving the food in the commissary. You have people who are making money doing the laundering of the uniforms that people wear inside a prison. So basically any kind of contact that there is with a prison, there's going to be a corporation that's making money off of it. And you can think about, well, if I'm a business person, I have to protect my business interests, and they're going to make sure that there is a continuing supply of money that's coming from the prison system. So that goes into lobbying and campaign contributions to make sure that the people that they're making money off of, there's enough of them in there to make it a worthwhile business opportunity. So when I think about the prison industrial complex, I generally think about all the different ways that there's corporations making money off people and then reinvesting that money to make sure that there's still people inside a prison to make money off of.
Got it. So it's like the economic ecosystem, like the thing that perpetuates and keeps the money flowing here and how you extract it out of that population, basically.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's just the whole, everything that's built into it. So public prisons, private prisons, the people that are inside are part of the prison industrial complex, even though they're being, you know, the values being extracted from them, anything that's touching the prison system at all, I think we can sort of capture inside of that big umbrella.
Got it. Okay. And now you guys are specifically focused on this idea of abolishing specifically the private prisons. So I guess when I first came to this, my initial take was, well, why, you know, privatize stuff as it relates to government is typically more efficient. So I would think at the outset, without knowing any, you know, without doing any research, I would think they're probably doing it more effectively than the government could do it. Why is that not the case?
Yeah, I mean, I just want to push back a little bit because I think in the United States, we've maybe gone a little overboard on the privatization stuff. I think there was this idea, in especially that grew up in the 1980s, that was private's better. You know, there's no bureaucracy, you can be more efficient, you can do things better. And certainly that's the case in some places, you know. And from abolish private prisons perspective, we would never try to say that the government should not work with private parties, right? Like public-private partnerships have a very positive role and impact in the world. You know, like we can see how well these partnerships work on things like road projects, right? Like all of the workers that work on road projects are not business employees or not government employees. They're contracted out, and it allows the government to have flexibility with how they do bids. And, you know, they can scale up very quickly and scale down very quickly when they need to, you know, build more roads or fewer roads. So the idea of a public-private partnership is not anathema. It's particularly problematic when somebody's liberty is at stake. And there's several reasons for this, but one of them is that, you know, that person has no choice in the matter. So we think of the free market as there being these choices. And it gets weird when the person who should be making the choice, because that's the person who's sort of experiencing the effect of it, is not the one making the choice. The government is really the customer in some of these relationships, but they have no interest in making sure that, you know, the conditions are okay. You know, as long as they're constitutionally permissible, you know, they're going to do as little as they can to make sure that happens. So that's one part of it, is that it sort of corrupts the whole idea of the market when you take the person who's making the decision away from the person who's expecting to reap benefits from that. Because that's sort of the whole idea of how buying and selling is going to reach some optimal outcome. But I think one of the more pernicious ideas is that the business of the private prison operator. And I guess step back just real quick. When we say private prisons, we like to talk about companies that own and operate this facility 24/7. They have complete control over the people that are inside the facilities. They aren't just coming in and contracting out for bits and pieces of it. They own, operate, and manage the entire process. So that's really when we're talking about private prison operators, who we're going after. So that's a corporation that has, at this point, a lot of money, and they can invest that money into lobbying and campaign contributions to fight against any of the common sense criminal justice reform that, you know, has broad bipartisan support, right? Like, I think in especially the late 2010s and moving into the 2020s, there is a bipartisan push to realize that we've gone too far with criminal justice. We're locking too many people up for too long. It's costing the government too much money. It's racist. You know, there's a lot of reasons why people come to this issue, but broadly people are saying we need to pull back on this a little bit. And those corporations have a fiduciary interest to make sure that those reforms don't happen. They have to protect their stockholders and make sure that they can continue to take money out of it. So that is really, I think, the pernicious part, is that they are invested in making sure that there's a continuing supply of people in prisons. And then when the people get released, they come back. So they have no incentives to provide programs to make it less likely that people commit crimes in the future, things like that.
Right. I mean, the more I read about this, the more it struck me is this is essentially like a hotel industry. It comes down to the same business model as a hotel industry, right? Like, only there's government contracts, and these hotels, these prisons, are getting paid a per diem for how many beds they have filled. So of course you're going to get this perverse incentive to make sure that like all the beds are occupied, that there's customer retention, that they keep coming back, recidivism, and that you extract as much profit out of those people as possible, which means, you know, reducing all the services and all that. So it's a really, now that I understand it, I get why this business model is just so corrupt for, like you said, when people's liberty is at stake, it makes no sense to make this a for-profit endeavor.
Right. And there's some like strange things that happen when in this relationship that would never happen anywhere else, right? Like, one of the things that surprised me, because like you, when I came to this issue, I had sort of these free market ideas about letting private companies do things. And then you start reading about it and you realize how really crazy some of these things are. For example, one of the things is that in most of the contracts, and maybe not all, but many of them have a 90% occupancy guarantee. So no matter how many people are actually in the prison, the government is going to pay the private party as if 90% of those beds were full, right? And it's really, when we think about government corruption and stuff, that is the kind of contract that a private party is not going to sign if they can possibly help it, right? Like, they're going to want to say, we're only going to pay you for the beds that are full. It doesn't make sense for us to continue paying if they're not going to be full. And there's a lot of these things.
Like, once you're paying that rate for 90% occupancy, then it's in your best interest to make sure that you're getting your money's worth.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So it's wrinkles and wrinkles in things that, like, it just doesn't make sense from anybody's perspective, except the private prison industry and except for the politicians who are making money through this, you know, campaign contribution and lobbying kickback that they get. It's really the only two stakeholders that are making any positive effect out of this.
How do you answer the concern when someone comes back and says, well, these are people that are in prison, they clearly did something wrong, they deserve it, I'm not trying to give them like a cushy Club Med experience here, they should suffer, it's part of the punishment. How do you counter that argument? What's your response to that?
Yeah, you know, I think, first of all, those people should go to a public prison and see what it's like, because it's not Club Med. I think even in, we have this sort of, you know, Hollywood idea that comes about that if you go to like federal prison, it's like a resort or something like that. You know, people talk about playing golf or watching cable all the time. It's not like that. It's really terrifying in like an existential way when you walk into a prison and you hear the doors clang behind you. Like, you know that you cannot get out. You look back behind you, there's these steel bars that are like locking you in there, you know? And every time I go to a facility, as an attorney, I know I'm getting out of there in 30 minutes. You know, I'm meeting with a client, we're, you know, prepping for whatever we're doing. But even those 30 minutes are like really crazy. It's hard to explain just how like life-changing it is to be inside of a prison, even for a short amount of time. And I think if you understood that person who said, you know, we're not trying to put these people in Club Med, I think if they had an idea of what prisons actually look like, it wouldn't even be a question that they were thinking about, you know? And so you go from there. And if that's how the government's running things, right? The reason that the private industry thinks they can do it better is they're going to cut costs. And when you think about how you can cut costs from a public prison, it's the most like shocking thing you can think about. It's people like when it's hot in Arizona in the summer, right? The inside of these prison facilities are high 90s, 100 degrees. You know, you're like baking inside of one of these places. It's hard to take anybody seriously who thinks that people need to be punished more severely than they are in a public facility.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, just to throw this out there. So my father has been involved with correctional institution reform very much. Like he's a attorney in Arizona and has long pushed back on the Arpaio, like tiger cages and the pink underwear and all the nonsense with that. So this is something that, and likewise, I have an aunt who has worked her whole life in prisons teaching artwork to the inmates. And so it's like, this is something that is like, I've bumped up against, I guess, throughout my life, but getting the deep dive after reading the Shane Bauer book, and I highly encourage people to read that. I'll link to it in the show notes. It's an eye opener. It's really, this guy, he was basically like an investigative reporter for Mother Jones and went undercover and worked as a prison guard. I think it was Wynn Penitentiary in Louisiana, which was a CCA, a core civic facility. And it's just basically his experience and what he, you know, firsthand seeing how you cut costs and what that leads to and the impact of that. So I'm challenging you with some of these questions that I had before I started researching it and what your response is, but 100%.
Totally. No, it's, you know, I lived in Arizona and I talked to people that supported the Arpaio camps, you know, and he did that in a very interesting way. Cause I think on the outside, if you hear that they were forced to wear these like pink uniforms or whatever, it's easy to dismiss that as like that's cute, sort of get over it. In the context of just how much you are dehumanized as a person when you're in one of those facilities, it's really just rubbing your face in how little of a human you are, right? Like the fact that you get referred to as a number, like all of these decent human things are stripped away from you, and then to put you in a pink uniform, it's cruelty for the sake of cruelty. There's no other reason for it. And it's that kind of stuff that is like, it's easy to dismiss as like cutesy, but it just shows you how people on the other side that are like running these facilities, it's how they see the stock of their prisoners. You know, they don't see them as people.
Well, I think it's easier for them to do their job if they can distance themselves in the same way that, you know, like they say, like doctors to not establish a very personal relationship with their patients because it's easier for them to like make objective kind of emotionless decisions. I think in the same way, you know, as one podcast that you guys had, where you're talking about like the people around the cherry wood table making these shareholder decisions and whatnot. If they had actual personal in-person, you know, like dealings with the prisoners, that would make it very difficult, I think, for them to make some of the decisions they do about cost cutting. And, you know, it's easier if they're dehumanized than it is if they're humanized.
No doubt about it. And I think that's one of the, first of all, Shane Bauer is an incredible person. Like reading his book is worth it. Even if you like, you're not that into nonfiction or anything like that. He's an incredible writer and an incredible person. The courage to go into that facility, like knowing what he knew. But I think to your point, he is a compassionate guy, right? Like he, just speaking to him, you get the sense that he understands people's humanity, and his experience working as a guard in one of these facilities, it showed how much you have to do that. Like you end up being like an us versus them scenario. Otherwise you can't do your job, just like you're saying. So like that's somebody who has a very compassionate core, knew he was doing this as a project and still succumbed to this urge or this necessity to dehumanize the other just to do his job.
Right. And he talks about that, like getting to the point where he'd go home and he was kind of terrified because he like relished the power. He found himself like, you know, enjoying like hearing inmates, you know, like say, yes, sir. And like bowing to him basically. And then he kind of had that shudder of realizing like, I'm becoming this thing that I hate, like 100%.
Totally. We haven't released it yet, but we talked to Shane Bauer as one of the podcast episodes with Prison Cells. And I tell him since then, every time I've talked to him or whatever, I say, basically every time I do something could turn into like a Shane Bauer fan episode. Cause like that book was so good and like, it's so important in how people think about it. So yeah, we could talk about Shane and that book for a while.
I just finished it. It's worth a read for sure if you're interested in this stuff. I guess a question I have is, why has the prison not followed the same trajectory as healthcare? It seems like healthcare is coming around to this notion of like patient outcomes and switching the model so they're compensated based on how well it works, not this idea of filling a bed. So why hasn't prisons adapted to some form of like rehabilitation success, you know?
Yeah, it's a good question to pose to the people who are running the facilities, you know, like that they could do that model if they wanted to. I just don't think that they have any reason to. It's harder for them, right? Like it's much easier to run a facility where you strip away everything and you don't have to care about outcomes. It's cheaper that way. You save a lot of money and you can charge the government the same rate. So who cares? And so there is a facility, and I always forget whether it's in New Zealand or Australia, that is run on this concept, right? Like they are paid more when the outcomes are better. So it's not a model that is undoable. You just need somebody who cares enough to try that. And I think part of the issue is, like you were talking about earlier, in the United States, there is this retribution aspect to how we deal with the criminal justice system. We think people deserve to be punished in some sense, right? Like that you talk to people and they like the dehumanization aspect of it. They like that people are miserable when they go into these facilities. So I think there's not enough public pressure on the government to say, treat these people like humans. And then, so the government has no real incentive or impetus to go to the private prison vendor and say, you got to do better, right? Like all that the government wants to say is you got to do cheaper. And it's not even clear that they're doing that, by the way, but that's the one impetus that the government has at all.
So this, it seems though, is at the very crux of this whole issue, is that like, I'm not even sure if the private aspect is the culprit necessarily. Like if the incentives were structured correctly, do you think private prisons could work, or does it, or do you think that it just needs to literally not be a private industry?
Yeah. I mean, that's a complex question, and it's one that we've struggled with because we would like to see a better prison system in the United States, right? Like to the extent that a prison system needs to exist at all, it should be better than it is. And there's a question about whether we should have a prison system at all. You know, there's a growing and strong abolition movement that makes good points. And, you know, there's experiments going on across the world that are treating people different ways and moving to like a more treatment-based model rather than a criminalization-based model. But if we're going to have a prison system in the United States, it at least needs to do better, right? And there's a constitutional question, I think, about whether a private person is allowed to be involved in that at all. Like, I think the fact that we have a history of slavery in the United States, and even if it is a private prison system in which the person is making more money if the prisoner releases and doesn't have a recidivism, you know, impact in the future, that person is still making money off the ownership of another person and raises serious 13th Amendment concerns, right? So, and there's a moral question about whether a person should be allowed to make money off the ownership of another person because of the way that, you know, that they're involved in the criminal justice system. I also think there's like a political philosophy question about, you know, when we agree to this social contract with government, right? One of the things that we agree to is like the government has these powers to enforce social order, and we get a benefit from all of that because we get to live in a society where there's roads and schools and stuff. And the flip side is the government has the power to enforce the rules. I don't think part of that social contract includes a private party enforcing laws against me, you know, like, except in these maybe very fleeting instances, like, you know, fleeing felons or something like that. But I don't think part of the social contract is that if I break a law, a private party gets to benefit from that. So I think there's like very serious moral and philosophical questions about whether that should exist. But maybe the benefits would be so huge, right? Maybe the private prison in this, you know, fantasy world, maybe the private prison is just so effective and like so innovative that they could do these things. that's not what we have today, but maybe in this fantasy world that would be a possibility. And I'd love to see some evidence of that, you know?
Yeah, I guess my thinking is just that, like, the two seem to be independent things, like private versus government run, and then the incentives being right. And all things being equal, it's like you could switch from private to all public and it could still be a disaster, because as long as you're incentivizing based on bed occupancy, you're going to get what you incentivize. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you get the incentives right, it seems like you can have whatever type of organization fulfilling that, and it won't really matter as much, because it's all about, like, do we have the right rehabilitation metrics, and are we rewarding folks for delivering those outcomes? It's outcome based versus, like, just headcount based.
Right. You know, and I think these are the interesting conversations that we should be having with the private prison corporations, and they're just not the ones we're having, right? Like, yeah. I think that is a fruitful conversation that a policymaker could have with a private prison. Like, why don't you come to me with a contract that encourages these things, right? But when you look at what's actually happening, when they put out an RFP, a request for a proposal, none of that happens, right? It's just, we do this many beds, this occupancy rate, this per diem. And so, I think we need, if that's the model that people want, we need to put pressure on legislators to say, negotiate, like, really negotiate these things. Don't just take the RFP that they're giving you. And frankly, what I think would happen in the real world is the private prison doesn't want any part of that. It's not a profitable model for them, right? Like, they want to operate in this very simplistic way where they have a per diem rate that they can count on, $92 per compensated man day, which is, like, it's crazy corporate language, right? Compensated man day that we think about, but they want to know that they're getting $92 per day. And then all they have to focus on is, how can I push my spending as low as possible to increase that revenue margin, right? That profit margin. I don't think they want any part of a system where they have to track people for 10 years after their release and see how many of them have jobs, how many of them have education, how many of them have committed another crime. It's just not worth it for them. You know? Like, they have all the incentive to keep it as it is. So, you know, and I think one other thing about it is the government implicitly has those incentives, right? The government is going to be spending this money if somebody comes back to a prison facility, which are, by the way, it's expensive. Most states that we go to, when a abolished private prison goes and gives a presentation somewhere, we bring data with us. And one of the things that we often look at is, how much does your state spend keeping somebody incarcerated for a year versus how much does it cost to send somebody to college for a year? Tuition, board, room, everything. Most states spend more incarcerating people, right? So, like, all of the government has the incentive to keep people out of prison just based on the fact that they're the spender. And so they should be the ones that are doing these experiments, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, let's talk about, these interviews tend to take a certain structure. So we talk about basically, like, the scope of it, the impact, deep dive on the problem, and then brainstorm solutions. So let's talk about impact to communities. Some of this is obvious, but, like, what are the effects of this mass incarceration? And specifically, it seems to tend to target certain socioeconomic groups. What is the impact of that on communities?
Yeah, I think there's two levels to that question too. One is just the mass incarceration problem in general. A lot of stuff has been written about this, right? It impacts poor people. It impacts communities of color. The whole criminal justice system is racist to its core. It's built on a history of slavery, and that shows up in how things are enforced, what the consequences are like, and all of that, right? And I'm not even an expert in terms of the consequence of the mass incarceration system on communities of color, because it's such a giant problem, but I'm at least familiar enough with it to just know that it's a racist structure, know that it hurts poor communities and communities of color way more. A lot of that is built into the way that the courts operate, the fact that if people of means can afford an attorney, the public defender system in the United States, those people are hardworking and they're trying to do right, but they have so many cases that there are now public defenders who are saying, I can't provide constitutionally acceptable counsel to my clients. I have too many of them, right? And they're starting to feel like if they do their job, they're breaking ethical rules. It's like, so part of it is, public defenders need to be way more funded, you know, and the there needs to be more social investment into poor communities and communities of color. It's a deep, deep problem that there's not an easy solution to. And the fact that mass incarceration shows up is really, it's both in a cause and effect, right? Like just changing criminal justice is not going to change the deep-rooted socioeconomic problems that are in these communities. So that's one part. It's bad is just one way to say it. It's terrible. So privatization layers on top of that system, right? So anytime you're talking about private prisons, you have to talk about the mass incarceration system first. And it's a newer system, so there's not as much research on this, but it looks like even within this already racist system, private prisons disproportionately affect people of color, even on top of that, right? So even when we're already in that system. And one of the reasons that people think that it's like that is because the prison corporations want cheaper prisoners, right? If they're getting a set amount of revenue, it costs more money for them to provide medical care, to lock people up in solitary confinement because you need more cells or whatever. So if you're a private prison corporation, you want the youngest, healthiest clients possible. And those tend to be communities of color because of the way that the laws are structured. So you have these, it's like a racist system on top of a racist system. And the effect is, you know, because of the collateral effects of running into the criminal justice system, it's harder to get a job afterwards. It's harder to get scholarships to go back to school afterwards.
By the way, improves their customer retention. If you think about it, it ensures at least some level of recidivism, because you make it hard to do anything afterwards than what was safe, prison. So you're going back.
Exactly. So, you know, the whole thing is just this, like, it's a negative feedback loop that the private prison takes advantage of, and it makes communities worse. And then the flip side of it is the private prison corporations make the communities worse where they are, right? Like, I think that's one of the interesting things from the Shane Bauer book, is he talks about just how awful the wages are and the working conditions. They promise these rural communities, oh, we're going to bring in, you know, 700 great jobs to your community. First of all, they're awful jobs. They're very dangerous. They have an incredibly high churn rate where people quit within the first year because they realize how awful it is, how few benefits they get, how they're not getting paid. But it makes the communities dependent on the few jobs that they have. And so it not only negatively affects the people who are in prison, it negatively affects the communities that are there. Basically, nobody wins from the system except for the corporate shareholders and the politicians that are benefiting from it.
Got it. Yep. I mean, it's basically a wealth transfer, it sounds like, at this point, to the shareholders of these groups like Geo Group and Core Civic. It's government contracts, taxpayers pay into it. But if we were like looking at the yield, like the return on investment there, we're not getting our money's worth for those services. We're getting actually a terrible outcome, which is, you know, these worse communities, worse jobs, recidivism, all that stuff. So
yeah, I think an analogy that I've been like thinking about recently is like the old company towns, where you have this like government money that comes in through, you know, contracts or whatever. And then the people who are actually making money in a company town are not the workers who are living there, right? They're living in squalid conditions. They're, you know, forced to work in this one company, because that one company owned everything. The only people who benefited from these company towns were the company, right? And so you have the same thing in these private prisons, where the people who are inside don't have much choice, right? The people who are working there don't have much choice because they own everything around them. And the only people who are extracting the government money, right? We're all paying for it. It's coming from our tax dollars. And they're just skimming off the top of it to make the corporation richer and then kicking back some to the politicians to make through this lobbying and campaign contribution. So it is
that's like just cost of doing business. Yeah. Exactly. That's their cost of doing business, is to grease the wheels and get the right laws passed and all that. Okay. Can we talk about just like the landscape here in terms of the stakeholders that are involved? And like the way I see it, there's like government, there's these public companies that we alluded to, the shareholders of those companies. It sounds like the lobbyists required to, you know, get the right laws in place, legislators, police. Like, can you position those elements? Are there more than that, or is that kind of the landscape?
Yeah, I think one interesting thing, those are the important ones for sure. I think that you've nailed most of them. Of course, the people who are forced to be in prison there are a stakeholder that they don't get much choice in the matter, but they're impacted by it. You have unions who are big stakeholders, because what happens, you know, one way to frame this private prison issue is as an anti-labor effect, right? Because you have the public prisons are almost exclusively staffed by union labor, right? By these officers. And the private prisons don't. They have guards that are not unionized. And so one way to see it is this anti-union thing. And they have been very good allies with abolish private prisons because they see the issue. You know, they care about officer safety and they care about the standards of their job, none of which are respected by these private prison corporations. So I think that's one that often gets overlooked, is the people whose jobs are being stripped and given to people who are, you know, making way less money, way less benefits, and in a way less safe situation.
Got it. Yeah. And I remember towards the end of that book, actually, he talked about, I think it was Bockel, one of the characters in the book, was saying, hey, you know, Walmart just raised their minimum wage. It's almost identical to what we're making. Something to think about, you know.
Yeah, you're not going to get stabbed, right? Yeah. Like, and maybe it's not even funny because, like, those jobs really are unsafe. But it's just hard to deal with it in any way that's not humor. But those people really are being taken advantage of in these poor communities and promised these jobs that turn out to be really horrible.
Yeah. Okay, well, so let's talk about your guys' approach here. So you are attacking the constitutionality. You mentioned the 13th Amendment. Can you just, for the people listening, like, remind us what that is?
Yeah, 13th Amendment, at least nominally, abolished slavery in the United States. Neither slavery nor involuntary servitude, except for punishment for a crime having been duly convicted, shall exist in the United States. I didn't get that exactly right, but that's more or less it. And so that's one of the main arguments we make, is that the mere fact that a person is being held, you know, and it's not even a forced labor issue. Their value is being extracted from the mere existence of that human being, and another person is making money off that. And that exactly mirrors chattel slavery in the United States. And we think it's exactly what the 13th Amendment was meant to get rid of. There's some, like, complicated legal questions about what does the punishment clause mean exactly, that, you know, I'm happy to go into. I don't think it's a legal podcast and that we could spend a lot of time talking about it, but that's really what it is. I mean, it's we argue that it is slavery to hold somebody else and extract value from them. And so that's the 13th Amendment. We also have a 14th Amendment claim, which is due process, which, simplified all the way down, basically just means that the government has to treat you fairly. And what fairly is depends on a lot of things. Like, they obviously don't have to treat everybody the same. If you've been convicted of a crime, they can put you in prison. But even when you're in prison, you have these constitutional rights. And we think it's this, all of these incentives that we've been talking about today, when you layer all of those on top of each other, that triggers a due process concern because it affects somebody's liberty, which is one of the things that the 14th Amendment protects. So again, you know, we could spend 8 hours just talking about due process, but ultimately it comes down to, is the government treating you fairly, and are they providing enough procedural safeguards to make sure that other people are treating you fairly?
Got it.
That's the 14th Amendment. We also have 8th Amendment, which is cruel and unusual punishment, which is, like, holding somebody in these conditions where they're being treated like a slave violates the cruel and unusual punishment clause.
Got it. But so you're attack here, though, is to list these, the 8th and 13th and 14th, and the violations that you believe are happening. But then what is your intended outcome? What is your hope? You're going to overturn these things and then what, declare private prisons just unconstitutional and they got to be shut down?
Exactly. And then, and one of the, you know, these complex things about constitutional cases is the different clauses and amendments have different remedies. So I can, like, if we win on the 13th Amendment, it's hard to imagine even a sort of recidivism-based model passing muster, right? Because that's based on the ownership of somebody else. But under the 14th Amendment, maybe it is possible that they could set up a way that was procedurally fair to people. You know, so it's contextual, and it would depend on which argument the court accepts and things like that. But ultimately, the goal is to get the Supreme Court to say that the Constitution doesn't allow these kinds of arrangements. Yeah.
So I guess, maybe this is a dumb question, but, like, the Supreme Court just overturned Roe v. Wade. It seems like you're entering into an era when this type of, it's like, it was hard before to make this change. Like, aren't you worried that this isn't going to be next to impossible now to get the current Supreme Court to see this perspective?
Yeah, I think I think you wouldn't be a good lawyer if you weren't worried about how hard your case was going to be. And certainly there's challenges to this. But I think there's also some opportunities that this kind of court presents. One of the claims that we didn't talk about yet was non-delegation, which I sort of alluded to in the philosophy moments. But like, there's certain things that only the government can do, right? Only the government can run a military. Only the government can run voting, like the voting system. So, you have all those things, and our position is that only the government can run prisons. And that is a conservative issue, actually, is what kinds of things can be delegated. You see conservative judges and justices being curious about the non-delegation clause and what kinds of things that the administrative state in the United States is doing that they shouldn't be. There was just an EPA case released from the Supreme Court a couple of days ago that had a lot of these echoes, right? Like, Congress couldn't delegate the major question of what the EPA should be allowed to regulate in terms of greenhouse gases. And those are these echoes of non-delegation. They didn't actually use the non-delegation clause in that argument. They used the major questions doctrine, but they have in other cases. And it is a lean that the conservative court has been moving. So there's challenges with this court, but there's also opportunities.
Okay. Well, it's good to hear. Like, obviously you want your lawyer to believe that anything is possible, and you guys are going to need to have that, because this is clearly an uphill battle to get this overturned.
And just one other quick thing about the court is it takes a long time to get to the Supreme Court. You know, we filed our first case like 2.5 years ago or something at this point, and we're just now at the point where we're filing a brief in the Ninth Circuit, and that's going to take another couple years. And then, you know, it takes a long time to get the Supreme Court. So who knows what the court's going to look like, you know, because of the way it works. A couple judges retire or die, and then the court could be completely different. So you sort of have to, like, when you're thinking about 5-6 years down the road, you make your best arguments and you see what happens. And, you know, you do keep an eye on what's going on. You make your best arguments and you just have to see.
You get what you get by the time you get there. Yeah. So I guess a concern that I had is that you guys could, let's take the scenario where you actually succeed in what you're trying to do and you overturn the constitutionality of this, and you're successful in saying, nope, this violates the rules. It seems to me that anything barring making this like economically non-viable for the companies, they're going to find a way. As long as it's profitable, they've proven that they kind of eke around the rules to maintain their place in the world. So it seems like even if you succeed, you're going to have the cockroaches kind of finding their way around it to stay in place. How is there any strategy for just making this like not profitable for them somehow?
Yeah. So we work with other organizations who are frankly better than us at this point at doing the kind of grassroots organizing that's necessary for those kinds of things. There's been some very successful divestment campaigns where, frankly, student-run groups have gotten their colleges to divest, to say that our big tuition fund, I forget what their endowments, the endowments are not going to be invested into funds that have private prisons as part of their portfolio, right? This echoes something that's been very popular with the people who are, you know, fighting climate change, right? Like, making these green investment buckets that people, you know, these large organizations can invest into that have this morality of like, we want to fight climate change. And there's been some success in divestment campaigns. So that's one thing, you know. And there's been another organization that was successful in like putting pressure on banks to stop lending money to these organizations.
I read that. Yeah. It was like 8 banks, JP Morgan and a bunch of those guys, that all kind of at the same time said, nope, we're not going to finance you guys anymore. And that, like, their stock tumbled like 50% the next day,
which totally.
And it's pretty amazing.
Yeah, it's amazing. And, you know, banks are tricky too. They like continue to fund them in different ways. So like, as good a PR as that was, it wasn't like they completely severed ties. That's not to say that it wasn't effective, because you pointed out, it was effective, but just to say that these kinds of efforts need to continue, right? Put public pressure on these organizations from as many ways as possible, because it is something that I think that when people hear about, they have an instinctive reaction that it's wrong. And so you just need to tell people about the problem and get them convinced to care about somebody that's in prison. Once you can do those two things, you know, they really will get behind the effort, because it is this like instinctive moral problem.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it was the fourth podcast, the one that I listened to that you did most recently, or maybe it was the third one, where you're talking about almost like this greenwashing effect of like corporations that will pile on the bandwagon once it's cool to be a part of this. Once they see it, it's like, and your position, I think, was that, you know what, I don't even care the reason they're doing it. As long as if the money makes it to the people who are fighting the good fight, I'm not going to question their motives. And so yeah. To some extent, it's like, they don't need to even be doing it for the right reason necessarily. But if these banks are like defunding and not supporting them, then great.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, I understand people who really want like a moral commitment from corporations who are doing it for the right reasons, and that's great. And that if we can get there, that is good. But I think exactly. But like, you sort of take people where they are, and if you're going to help me, like, help me. And if you want to go home and talk about how they're fine, just do that. But like, let's help solve the problem first, and then we can talk about sort of the moral issues, and I can bring you on in a full sense. But like, yeah, I really do think that corporations speak with money, right? That's what they do. And so when they're giving money to something, trust them. Like, that's where they're putting their emphasis. And there is a caveat, which is like, that money actually has to be available. Like, you can't wrap it in layers of bureaucracy, put $5 million in a fund, and then 10 years later, you know, that is $7 million because it's accrued interest and nobody's having access to it. That doesn't help anybody. So, but if that money is actually available and doing good work, I think that's good enough.
Yeah. And you guys pointed out again in that same interview about how like, okay, the money's there, but we can't even access it. I think it was Tank and John went down to try and get something. It took like a day filling out a form that got them like $5,000 that should have been, you know, easier, way easier to access.
It was like harder than filling out a tax return. You know, like you needed a lawyer to help you. It's like, and you know, that's the corporation saying, we actually don't want to disperse that money. You know, they talk with money. And so when they're not dispersing it, they're telling you what they're saying.
Yeah. Totally. Well, we're into the solutions brainstorm component of this interview now. And you're talking like, in terms of what our volunteers can do, the people that are listening, you know, there are developers, designers, copywriters, SEO people, videographers. I don't think we can help you on the litigation front. I think obviously that's your guys' expertise. The divestment thing sounds interesting. So you mentioned the two things that need to happen are awareness. And then what was the other one? It was like reaching people, and then...
just caring about people in prison, I think, is the other part. Because like, if you, you were mentioning earlier, right? Like, you tell people private prisons are bad and we have all this evidence that says they're bad, and they're like, okay, who cares? They committed a crime. If you can't do the time, don't do the crime or whatever. So right. I think the first thing is awareness, and the second thing is just like a minimum amount of human compassion. Like, that, those are the two things.
So yeah, perfect. So... I have my own ideas, but without tainting your ideas, like, can I ask you, like, if you could just wave a magic wand right now and have us build anything for you, what could we make that could help the cause here?
Yeah. And I think that there's two sort of paradigms to look at this from. And one of them is from abolish private prisons aspect as an organization. And the second one is from like a movement idea, right? Where abolish private prisons is not front and center. From the APP mindset, we just need people to know who we are, right? Like, the more people that know about our website, that's one of the reasons that we did the podcast, like get people to listen to the podcast and then go to our website and just like see the kind of work we're doing and see if that's something that they can, you know, donate time or money to, right? Because I think we do present like a value proposition for people that are looking to donate inside of the criminal justice space. We're doing something unique, like literally no other organization like the ACLU or the Southern Poverty Law Center, all of these big name organizations, they're not specifically fighting against private prisons. And so we have like a niche that I think can interest people. On the bigger like movement side, like I think that there's a couple things that have always interested me and we just don't have the sort of infrastructure to do it. I would love to have an organizational like method to reach out to local legislators, because we talked about numbers at the beginning of the podcast. Most people that are held in private prisons are held in state, like are prisoners of a state, not the federal government. And so if there was, you know, like there's some very good organizations that have made it easy to see like who progressive people are that you should vote for, right? Like you type in your zip code and up comes a list of people with their policy positions and stuff like that. So whenever you're voting in a primary, you're like, here's the people that I can vote for. I think something similar to that, where I could type in my zip code It would populate a field that would be like, here's your state representative and your state senator. Here's positions, you know, they voted on these bills in the past. Here's some language that you can use to talk about private prisons and why you think they're bad, because, you know, pick A, B, C, or D because you don't like their, you know, criminal aspect, you don't like the effect on local communities or whatever. And it creates a template for you to either send a letter or call or something like that, right? So just make it very easy for people to reach their local representatives, because I think there's a lot of effort to make change there. You know, they really listen to people that are their constituents, because there's, you know, the territories are smaller, the numbers are smaller. So you can make real change if you tell your local legislator, like, hey, do this. Because it's not a big political issue yet. It's not like Republicans, Democrats. It's not abortion. It's not gun control. It's like small local things. And, you know, you can say, I'm not trying to say release everybody from prison. Let the state run facility handle it, because the state's good at it. So I think there's opportunities for like a nice, effective system to encourage grassroots organization at the political level. That would be my like number one thing, just like a way to organize people efficiently. I think there's also opportunities for these kinds of divestment campaigns. Like, you know, I can imagine a scenario where I went to a website and I typed in whatever mutual fund I'm invested in through my 401k or something like that. And it said, here's the six, you know, I looked through all of the stocks that this fund is invested in, and you're invested in Geo Group, CoreCivic, and these six companies that make money off of the commissary and laundry and stuff like that, and gave you a number for your fund manager to call and say like, hey, we need to stop investing in these corporations. So I think something like that, that leverages the power of information and local people to give them some effective tools to ask for change.
Yeah. I mean, so those two things could literally be combined into one almost like concierge app for someone who's concerned. Says, okay, step one, here's the legislator you need to contact. Here's a template. Here's some things, some talking points, and make it super frictionless. I've seen those before. I think the End the Exception with the guys that you work with, the Worth Rises folks, I saw that linked from their site, and that looked like a really neat tool. But it seems like that could almost be combined with this idea of what I'm calling like a shaming board, or I don't know, like a leaderboard that calls out the culprits and makes some kind of pressure on the pension, like the individual workers whose pension that is, can then say, hey, I'm not okay with this, and exert some pressure for divestment there. And like those two tools could essentially be combined into one little concierge app that's like, do step one, do step two. Here you go. That's the most impact you can have.
Totally. Yep. Yeah. I mean, and it doesn't take long, you know, like those kinds of efforts. I have local numbers on my cell phone that when things happen, I just call them, and like, you know, it's effective and it doesn't always feel effective. They're not going to be like, oh, I'm going to change my mind right now. But like this group of people over time can really affect change that way.
Yeah. Well, and also like it maybe as an N of one, it, whatever, there's no effect, but it's when you can orchestrate that at scale and have a drumbeat of those people calling in constantly, then that's when you start to have impact.
Exactly.
So on the other front, it sounds like getting people, you know, in terms of getting people to care and humanizing the prisoners, just some kind of campaign that we could do. I'm thinking specifically maybe with videographers or, you know, anything to make people see, because I think the problem here is that you get so distanced from it and you hear the violence and you think, oh, they're guilty and like they deserve to be there. And that just basically like they know they cease to be a human being to you. So anything we could produce in the way of like, I'm just like throwing a concept out here, but like one after another, a person like talks about their story for 15 seconds and like, and then there's a cadence of like, I'm a human. This is what I'm in for. I know it's wrong. Like, I'm a human. And if you can just like some kind of commercial almost along those lines that would just trigger people to be like, oh yeah, like, you know, I've had the wrong perception of like, I'm sure there's some bad people, but like a lot of these people are in there for the like wrong reason. And this is just stupid. So
totally.
I don't know.
And I think, you know, one of the, this just came to my mind. One of the interesting things that's happening inside of prisons these days is a greater access to technology, and it's not perfect. And a lot of it comes with like weird costs. Like they're still charging per minute and per text message inside of prison facilities, which
is $6 like, a minute or something like that.
It's really crazy. It just reminds me of like when cell phones first came out, like the crazy plans that happened in the United States that would charge you per text and per minute and all that stuff. But they're just like 30 or years behind in terms of how technology is developed. But I think that one of the opportunities there is if you can have a website where people who are inside of a prison can put their story, right? Like, yeah. You need both aspects of that you need to get stories from them and then get those stories out. And yeah. I think if you had an easy way for people to use their local the tablet that they have to tell their story, and then have another, you need like some intermediary in there that's like filtering those and producing them into something that's digestible. And sure. Then the other side is, you know, whether it's a podcast or it's just like a Twitter feed that's just like, you know, a 3-tweet thread every day of somebody's story or something like that. You know, like I think there's a lot of ways to get people's stories out there to humanize them, like you're talking about.
Yeah. That's a type of project that I think our folks with the mindset of like social media and marketing and video and like how to craft that in an effective way to tell that story. Yeah. That's more of a project in line with what I think we could pull off.
Totally. Hard to do video just because it's like hard to access the people.
I can imagine.
I think that's right. I mean, I think humanizing them and being like, these are people that are in there that whether, you know, it's not always people who are guilty who are inside, but even the people who are guilty, they're still people and they still should be treated like humans.
Yeah.
And I think people also don't understand like the small amount of like criminal activity that leads to these really harsh outcomes. You know, like that we just have such a punitive streak in the criminal justice system that like for very, very small violations can lead to some really crazy outcomes.
I guess that was the light bulb though for me, was that in thinking through, I think it was the mock shareholder thing that what you guys were talking about in one of your episodes. And then it's like, if you're sitting at the board table and you're like, okay, we've maxed capacity, where do we go? How do we keep increasing the stock price and in profits from here? Then you have to start to look and say, well, we can only do this a couple ways. We can, you know, build more things and fill them more. And we have to, in order to do that, we've got marijuana, which is becoming legal. So that takes away one of our legs to stand on there. So now we've got to think of new stuff to make illegal, and we've got to lower the bar for, you know, getting people with a violation. And so it leads to the situation that we now have, not surprisingly, that how we wind up here once you understand the whole complex and how it works.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's like everybody, not everybody, but it was like this increasing understanding of how corporations like run their meetings and stuff. I think it's just permeated through society in a lot of ways. More people are investing in the stock market and like paying attention to those kinds of things. So I think people, if you give them the opportunity, like you're running this company, what are you going to do to make more money? Everybody's got ideas, you know, just spend less money, you know, like yeah. Make more money, spend less. It's simple. And what does that actually look like for people?
Yeah. Yeah. And then last thing was that one of the guys was talking about how like he puts his students on an exercise to do this where they brainstorm and they do the mock shareholder meeting, and they get so into the game that they then forget, like their moral compass gets lost. And all of a sudden it's like, how do we maximize shareholder returns? And they start acting like the very people in these companies, you know? So it's not even, I guess it's just a human nature. Once you are kind of in the game and now you're trying to win the game, that this is how you behave.
Totally. I've seen it. I've like been at those exercises, you know, and like people yeah. change. It takes 30 seconds and all of a sudden they're not thinking about people anymore. They're just thinking about profits. Yeah. And a lot of that is like language that we use, you know, like the fact that in their reports, they call them compensated mandates. They don't talk about the amount of people that they're holding. You know, it's like all of these weird things that we do with language to just, I think it's to remove cognitive dissonance from our own brains, right? Like it's very hard to see somebody and treat them badly. Right? It takes like, you know, when you actually see somebody as a person in front of you, people do have this humanity, you know, it's like, you generally want to help each other. That's like humans have this societal instinct. That's how we became humans. And so in order to make that dissonance go away, you have to other them. And we do it through language, and we do it through the pink uniforms, and we do it through all these other ways. But it's just like a necessary component to treat people so badly.
Yeah, for sure. I think Twitter and social media is a very much like a testament to this, you know, is you see behavior on there that you would never see in person just because there's not a face behind it. And you're not, if you were looking at someone, you'd behave completely differently. So.
Totally. And we have like these avatars that are like not human avatars. And it all is a way to remove that like sort of instinctual compassion that I think people have.
Yeah. Well, Robbie, we're bumping up at the 1 hour mark. You guys are doing important work. How do people learn more about what you guys do? Where should we send them?
AbolishPrivateProisons.org is the website. Prison Cells is the podcast. We're going through an issue right now because we thought it was very clever to put a money sign as the S in Prison Cells. That makes it very hard to search for us. So it's actually Prison $ELLS. Hopefully that should be changed and fixed, but a Prison Money Sign ELLS is the podcast. You can find us on Twitter, Abolish Private Prisons. Our SEO is actually pretty good because we're the only organizations that's doing this exact thing. So if you search for us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and abolishprivateprisons.org, you find us pretty easily. We're always the first people that pop up.
Awesome. And we'll link all that in the show notes for the people who are listening. So if you didn't remember all that, it'll be on the website. Robbie, keep up the good work. You guys are fighting a good fight. We wish you the best of luck and we'll help however we can. So we'll be in touch.
Great. Sean, it's always good talking to you. Thanks again.
Cheers, man.
You've been listening to the Problematic Podcast. To get involved and propose a project idea of your own, or to join in the discussion around one of the projects proposed during the show, visit problematic.app. That's problem, ATTIC.app. Be sure to subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts and leave a rating and review on your favorite platform. Until next time, be the change.